Hi, hello, and welcome to another episode of The Dunker Spot. We are part of 342 Productions. I am your host, Nikias Duncan, and joining me, as always, is my co-host, Steve Jones Jr. Steve, how you doing, sir?
Hi.
We have the abbreviated intro, and we do not have a guest, which means we need to get a move on with basketball talk. But no, in all seriousness, hope you're doing well, friend. Excited for this one. We're dipping back into the Dunker Spot mailbag. As usual, if you have basketball thoughts, basketball questions, etc., you can always email us at dunkerspot@yahoo.com. That is dunkerspot@yahoo.com. But before we get to the mailbag, a couple things I want to talk about. One, we just had a tremendous basketball game between the Oklahoma City Thunder and the Cleveland Cavaliers. The Cavs keeping their winning streak alive, and as we record, they've extended their streak with the win against the Raptors as well. But a 129-122 victory over the Thunder. These were two top 10 offenses and defenses. The Thunder historically good defensively, the Cavs historically good offensively heading into this one. And we get a game in which both teams had an offensive rating over 122. But it didn't feel like we're just running up and down the gym getting easy shots. Like, it was a lot of movement. It was a lot of ball movement, a lot of player movement, a lot of let's pre-screen to get the matchup we want. Now let's flow into this pick and roll to see what you do with it. It was just a lot of high-level stuff from both teams. And so on a very basic level, I just had a ton of fun watching this game. It was nice watching Kenny Atkinson and Mark Dadnall just kind of move the chess pieces together. This was a game in which Shea dropped 30, but it wasn't his usual efficient 30. Donovan Mitchell did not shoot well in this game. So even if you came in looking for the MVP candidates to ball out in this one, probably wasn't what you were expecting. And even then, thought Jalen Williams was tremendous for OKC. Darius Garland, Evan Mobley, and Jared Allen were all tremendous for Cleveland. Max Strus making some big shots coming off the bench. A lot of movement shots. He was aggressive in this one. It felt like everyone had a moment in this game. You got to see stretches within this game of, oh, this is why OKC's defense is so good. When they're giving a switch and then swarming and forcing a turnover. Then you also see Cleveland. Oh, this is why their offense is so good. Let's put Hartenstein in action. You have small size at the rim. It's just Jared Allen sealing off a small defender. It's Evan Mobley sealing off a small defender. We got to see the Evan Mobley attacks in space. Oh, this is what the improvement has looked like throughout this regular season. Now he's putting his shoulder into Jalen Williams and ducking 3 feet down to do so and creating a clean look for himself at the rim. You just got to see elements of why these teams are so great. I love that this came down to a clutch battle at the end of this game. And for Evan Mobley and Darius Garland to kind of shut the door the way they did, I thought was a nice bow on the season that they've had to this point, both playing at an all-star level or better. So I just love everything about this. I know we're going to get nerdy with this game, but I just want to express my joy with what we saw in that basketball game.
So if you're tuning in, doing a set of curls, walking, folding some laundry, eating some oatmeal, Nikias has been buzzing about this game ever since it took place. Anything in between has not filled him with any sort of joy, which is why we're talking about it today. And they do match up next week. So I just want to give that disclaimer out there. This man is smiling like a young child at the current moment to give you a visual. I think the biggest thing for me in this matchup was two top teams doing what two really good teams do. I mean, you look at what both teams were able to accomplish. Oklahoma City, 48 made field goals, 35 assists. Cleveland, 47 made field goals, 36 assists. This was team basketball on both ends of the floor. And I think when you start to look at how each team was able to kind of counter each other, that was really where the fun started to take off. And I thought, for me, it was a nod to Cleveland. You know, this didn't have the feel. Like, I know some people walked away from the Milwaukee OKC NBA Cup game with questions about OKC. I didn't really walk away with questions about OKC. I mean, this is what, the second time they've lost in, what, 2 months or something like that?
Something ridiculous.
They're pretty good. I think it was more of a statement for Cleveland, okay, because I came in wanting to see what does it look like when they have to take a little bit of a punch. Like, I know we saw the Boston games earlier in the season, but what does it look like when they have to kind of figure it out on the fly? Because OKC has that defense that can make you do that. And I felt like they passed that test, and they were able to execute over and over and over again. I thought one of the subtle things that happened was the cutting that Cleveland had in this game and the way they used their spacing to just consistently beat Oklahoma City's rotations. And that's where it gets really fun because they can move so many people around the board and you don't necessarily have the automatic, okay, it's going to be this person showing this help every single time. There were guards in the dunker spot. There were wings in the dunker spot. There were bigs in the dunker spot. There were cuts from the corner. There was cuts from the short corner. And once they got downhill, it just got really tough for Oklahoma City in certain moments. And I think for Cleveland, they really did a good job with empty side pick and roll, empty side handoffs, empty corner dribble handoffs, and just the automatic nature. I think you felt, you know, it's when you call an offensive machine, it can make people feel a type of way, but they were just automatic as far as, okay, we're, you make this and we're going to make this read immediately. Jared Allen rolling, seeing help. Okay, let's get to the dunker spot. Let's look to the corner. Let's fake it. Let's get you in rotation, make you make a decision. That's where it got really tough. I thought OKC did a really good job on the other end of finding counters for them offensively. Didn't make enough shots. The zone got them in the second half, but mixing in the pick and roll. Like, I think the two-man game between Shea and Isaiah Hartenstein has been really, really good this year, and it gives them a different element because you're not sure, okay, are they going to start going to drive and kick? Are they going to pick and roll? Are they going to dribble handoffs? That was a good way for them to kind of understand, okay, we're close to where we want to be in the half court in some of these top-tier matchups, but we still have work to do.
Oh, I like it. I like it. Like, I think going back to the Cleveland offense, because this is something we watched in our online Dunker Spot watch party, so come rock with us with those. But it felt like that was something that you were calling out very often throughout this game. Like, hey, is this another cut for the Cleveland Cavaliers? So your point, I wanted to echo, I did love the way that they kind of altered the spacing. They'd empty a side, but where the other three were spaced around those two-man actions varied throughout the game. And OKC couldn't get a beat. And I think in this game, you got to feel both the speed of OKC and the way they flew around, were able to force the turnovers, but you also see when they don't have the appropriate size on the floor, or like just the other side of having that kind of speed versus the size. Because Cleveland obviously has this double big alignment of Jared Allen and Evan Mobley, if either of those guys are in the dunker and you're involved with guys like Hartenstein in action, who can contend with those guys, either immediately as a dump-off option, or if the shot goes up, now you're battling with those guys on the offensive glass. Like, it was something that I highlighted heading into this matchup. Like, OKC, best defense in the league by a mile, best half-court defense in the league by a mile, and they're doing this while being, I think, per clean the glass, 30th in offensive rebound rate allowed. They give up those extra opportunities, but they still get enough stops and force enough turnovers to where it really doesn't matter. And in this game, this wasn't a 20-turnover game for Cleveland. Like, OKC can do that to good offenses, but it wasn't one of those. And so with the success that Cleveland had with the drives, with the meticulous spacing that they had, they were able to generate good stuff. And then they also got some important second cracks at it on top of that. And I think OKC trying to compensate for that was interesting. I think both teams went to zone in this game, but I think OKC pulled out the zone first. And I was like, huh, this is interesting to me. Let's see how long they stick with this. And to Cleveland's credit, no, that's fine. You want to go zone, we will just get somebody in the middle. We are going to once again lean into the cutting behind that. I think one of the earlier possessions of the game is like a side out of bounds. And it's Evan Mobley kind of run from the baseline, gets to the free throw line, just kind of puts his hands on Isaiah Joe, like, hey, I'm here, but actually I'm not really here. Inbound goes in, goes back to Darius Garland, ping to Evan Mobley in the middle, then pretty much a no-look lob to Jared Allen over the outstretched arm of Isaiah Hartenstein. I was like, oh, goodness gracious. This is, I don't know if OKC is used to this kind of quick hitting. We know what you're doing. We're just getting to this immediately. And being able to tap those kind of buttons as consistently as Cleveland did. So I guess going to the Thunder side of this, like just keeping an eye on the size, like I think this is a matchup where I think they've always missed Chet. They've obviously won games, but when you have a 7-foot guy that can space the floor, that can attack off the bounce and can also just protect the rim to that degree, you miss that presence. And I think in this Cleveland matchup in particular, not having a second big either to play alongside Hartenstein to kind of counter what Cleveland was doing on the interior, or just as a substitute for Hartenstein, I think they kind of missed Chet in this game. I don't think he's going to be available for Thursday, though he is like doing, you know, he was at shooting, putting some shots up and stuff like that. I think he's closer to returning overall. I don't think we see him next week. But I do wonder what OKC takes from this from like a lineup perspective. I think the other Jalen Williams gave him some good minutes as well. But like, I wonder if it's just going to be the do better button, or if they actually try to tweak what some of the rotations look like, or what some of the coverages look like. Because something that I hit you with, and it isn't the first time I've done this year, but Hartenstein was at the level quite a bit. in this game. And we saw some drop. We saw some late switches later in that game, particularly in that fourth quarter. But him at the level, if you're giving Cleveland two on the ball, like they just have the playmakers to get that done, particularly Darius Garland. And again, it kind of exacerbates the lack of size underneath with how Cleveland's facing sometimes. So I do wonder, do we see a more conservative Hartenstein in terms of his coverages when we get this game on Thursday? Or this just need, the help needs to be more locked in, or Hartenstein has to impact the ball a little bit more when they go to that. I guess that's kind of where my brain goes.
I mean, I think the beauty of a rematch is that you have an idea of what they're trying to do a little bit more than you had seen on tape. You know, it's one thing to prepare for a team and understand what they do well, what they're going to, you know, try and do, how you can get to them. It's another thing when they've actually done it to you. So you can kind of just tweak what you do towards what they did. I think the biggest thing for OKC is more so just sustaining defense. And it's not necessarily they're a bad defensive team. It's that's what Cleveland does. They have possessions where, hey, screen, good. We go under. Rescreen, we're there. We recover. The third screen gets you. And now you're in rotation, and now they're finding the openings. I think being more prepared for some of the handoffs and the quick pick and rolls and the cuts from the weak side will probably help them out. I think the thing for Hartenstein is it's all about scheme versatility. I think the issue is probably some of the automatic shows in the second half where, you know, he was looking like he was about to hedge out before Darius Garland even came off the screen, and it was just a slip. I thought Cleveland got them with quite a few slips and scenarios when they were trying to switch or show, and they weren't able to necessarily lock that portion in. I thought Max Strus got them with a couple of those once he started to make shots, because, you know, he's coming off. You have to be up there. Either you're going to switch that or you're going to put two on the ball. They were nailing those slips so quick and getting the ball right to the roller that OKC never really got that heartbeat to really set up the rotations behind it. So you could see the rotations trying to get there. The ball is quicker than the man, and Cleveland was able to exploit that. So I'd expect that to look a little bit better in a rematch. But back to the Hartenstein point, I mean, they put him in drop. They had him at the level to start. They did late switches. They tried a little bit of everything. I think the key for them is being able to do a little bit of everything with him. And so for OKC, they don't necessarily want to give you one specific look over and over and over again. They want to be able to mix it up or take you out of your rhythm for what's working at that moment and then change it up later. So I don't necessarily have a concern with Hartenstein being up there. Yeah, the size is a little different on the rotations, and part of that is their lineup. Part of that is how Cleveland spaces the floor and how quick the cuts come. But you kind of have to have that versatility if you're going to survive throughout the playoffs, whether it's Chet, Hartenstein, whoever it is. So as far as lineups go, I just probably think it's a do better button.
Okay. Understood. I guess going to Cleveland's defense very quickly, I think something that we saw in the second half in particular, as I mentioned earlier, they both went to zone. But Cleveland going to zone late in that game, and OKC not, at the very least, not scoring efficiently against the zone looks. They overall pulling this up on second special really quickly. 0.7 points per possession against the zone. It was 17 reps or 15 possessions of zone for Cleveland in this one. From those possessions, did you feel it was a matter of OKC just missing shots, or did you feel like Cleveland stymied something that they wanted to do?
OKC never had the same rhythm they had against the zone in the first half. It felt like slower attacks. It felt like waiting. It felt like Cleveland was able to be active in that sense. So I think it accomplished its job as far as taking them out of a rhythm. It was probably my biggest takeaway.
Okay. It did, like, the tempo thing was going to be the thing that I pointed out. And, like, even looking at this on second spectrum, nearly 19 seconds per possession when Cleveland threw the zone at OKC. And that's just not the realm they want to be in. Like, I think some of the beauty of OKC is something that you've talked about quite often. If the first action doesn't go, we keep going. We keep going. Here's a drive. Here's a kick. Here's another kick. Here's another drive, et cetera. But against the zone, like trying to process where the openings were going to be, well, one, getting into it, and then from there, processing where the openings were going to be, and then taking the opening shot, taking the open shots that they were going to be there. Like, I think there was at least one possession late where you end up getting a swing to Jalen Williams, and he passes up a three, and they end up working later in the clock to try to generate a look. And it's one of those, if you've been keeping an eye on Jalen Williams over the past couple of years, that has been some of the conversation with him. We know you can shoot. Are you willing to take these shots? Are you willing to bump the volume up? Like, that's been one of my subtle favorite parts of his season this year, that he has been more willing to pull off the bounce and off the catch from deep. You saw some of those pockets of hesitancy and trying to, I guess, just puncture that space in the middle of the floor against that zone. So I think that's something that's easily fixable, honestly, just in terms of him. Like, he can just pull the trigger, or if he is going to drive, just drive, make the decision to drive a little bit quicker than he did, particularly in that four. But oh, look, you got to say something.
Well, no, it doesn't help. You had three straight turnovers when they went to the zone to start, because you tried to drive twice, and then you tried to get in the middle and couldn't get it. And that's a credit to Cleveland for the activity. I think what you kind of saw, and I give Cleveland credit for, again, rotating and working hard, they were trying to find an advantage in that zone to try and, again, because the biggest key to beating an NBA zone is to kind of tilt it, make them not be able to be matched up. And Cleveland did a really good job of closing out towards the wing and trying to discourage that corner pass and funnel the drive towards the middle where there were bodies. And so I think some of the hesitation was, okay, this pass should be there. Oh, it's not there. Now I got to drive. Now I'm driving into traffic. Where's my kick? Et cetera, et cetera. So I think that's something that OKC will likely clean up if Cleveland wants to bring that zone back out. But I think the timing of it and the fact that OKC turned it over a few times didn't help. Then they were out of rhythm, but they were still in the game.
Mm-hmm. Gotcha. I think one of the early turnovers that we saw in that fourth quarter was like Shea trying to iso Darius Garland as he was at the top. And you try to get that pass back to the wing that would have set up a corner shot for, I think, Isaiah Joe. And it's just a deflection. It's going the other way for Cleveland. So to your point, being able to make those passes, being able to keep Cleveland rotation and ultimately generate the shots you want is going to be big key for OKC. Okay.
Well, while we're talking about Cleveland's defense, I would like to point out again, you saw the willingness for them to switch Darius Garland onto different matchups. You saw, again, the willingness to switch Jared Allen onto different matchups and to be able to play out of that. I think that's important. That's a key element for them to be able to continue to display that, because those guys are going to get attacked and they're going to have to hold up defensively. You only got to do so much. And then the other part that I felt when going off the beaten path, this Cleveland team has, you know, I go back to the preseason when Kenny Atkinson really talked about the depth of this team. And that always stuck with me because he really believed in who they had. And when you look at what they've done this season, they've got options, folks. So it's not just the fact that you've maximized Darius Garland, Evan Mobley's playing at a great level in a different way, quick decisions, being decisive, moving across the board. I love his usage, by the way. You don't know if he's going to get a pin down from the block, inverted pick and roll, space. He's making quick decisions. Wanted to get that point out there. But they've got multiple options to play with those four. And you put that on top of the fact that they can stagger the top two. And it's like, okay, you deal with all four. Now it's two of them. Now it's two of the other ones. But you have, okay, Ty Jerome is giving us minutes.
Big minutes.
Caris LeVert is giving us minutes. Dean Wade is giving us minutes. Max Strus is giving us minutes. So you don't know which one it's going to be, and they can kind of mix and match depending on what their team needs, what the scenario desires, which is something that they haven't necessarily had before. You know, we sat here for years on this pod saying, hey, can Okoro just make a shot? Can Caris LeVert's defense hold up? They just need one of them to do one thing. And now they got about four or five options. Mm-hmm. And they can win a game where Donovan Mitchell goes 3 of 16. And they can walk away saying, hey, we probably don't win that game last year. They probably don't.
It's a testament to the depth. Like Mitch and Max Strus was 17 off the bench. And his impact as a screener, someone that can also draw two against OKC. Ty Jerome with 15 off the bench. Some really important drives for Ty Jerome, particularly in that second half. Just putting his shoulder into the chest of guys and getting to that funky floater that he's been really good at this year. And so, we just had the full-blown Cleveland episode, but their depth stepping up in this way while the Stars are also doing this is where Cleveland is off to this absurd start that only like five or six teams in NBA history have had, and most of them went on to win the championship. So I am, again, excited to see this again on Thursday and see what kind of tweaks are made. Like, do we get... Again, I don't think we get Chet next week, but do we get Alex Caruso back? If so, how does that alter what OKC does on either end? Like, do we see some quicker decisions in the half court now because the ball just generally buzzes when Caruso gets it? Do we unlock more stuff with him as a screener? How does that change the matchup? And for Cleveland, just nails, man. Like, even on a night where Donovan Mitchell doesn't shoot well, like, still was able to get into the teeth of defense and make some reads for you. And ultimately, there's just a level of attention that he draws, even on nights that he doesn't have it going. Like, I did just enjoy the battle between him and Lu Dort. Those are always just fun. But, like, there's still a level of gravity that he has. And when you have Darius Garland playing at this level, Evan Mobley playing at this level, Jared Allen would the quietest 25-11-6 that you may see in a marquee matchup like this. Just hit all the right notes, press the right buttons. And you mentioned the switching, how impactful that was. Cleveland continuing to switch at a high level and at a higher rate than last year. Just something that we've talked about before. This was just elite stuff. I had a ton of fun with this one. Shout out going through the role players. 11 off the bench for Aaron Wiggins. Timely drives for him as well. Cason Wallace with 15 points. His usage all over the place. Complimentary in terms of who he was switching onto defensively. Some of the on-ball signs he took. Use as a screener. The secondary attacks for him, he was huge in this one. Talked a little bit about the Hartenstein defense, but 18-11-8 for him in this game. Plenty of short roll reads, and those floaters were still there. And Jalen Williams, 25-9. Shea with 31 wasn't the most efficient night for him, but still, immense amount of pressure that he puts on your defense. I love getting the random battles where he gets Evan Mobley on the switch. Let's see what happens here between one of the best offensive players in the league and Evan Mobley, who is a DPOY candidate, in my opinion. This game had everything. And if you didn't enjoy this game, I feel a little bit sorry for you. But we run it back on Thursday.
Do you sneak in efficiency in there, buddy?
In a game like this where both teams did the thing, I mean, hey. But
man had 30 and almost shot 50%. Come on, brother. It's hard. The whole defense is looking at him.
It is. That's why he's great. If he had nailed as consistently as he does, I'm just saying. But any closing thoughts on Thundercast before we move?
No. Is there anything else you would like to say about this matchup?
That was real hoop. I think that's where I land. Also, just quick shout out to how that game was promoted. I think that is a thing that could be done more consistently across the board. I don't think it should just take a historic matchup for games to be talked about in the way that they were talked about and broadcast the way that they were broadcast. So we just... The league is great. The league is talented. We can just use that as a template. But
I do have a question to push back. How else do you can't really promote a historic matchup if it's not historic?
I think just the general tenor of this is what these teams do well. This is what these teams are going to look to take away. It's very basic, reductive, et cetera. But like, I do think there's more of a foundation to be built about this is what we like, and this is what you should be looking forward to. And this is the tone that we can talk about this. Like, obviously, you don't get 15-game win streak versus 10-game win streak, top of the conference, et cetera, to your point. But I think overall, like, there could just be, we can dig in on whatever teams are in the marquee. That's the general point that I'm making.
Man saw efficiency on a graphic and lost his mind.
Here we... Oh, anyway. Let's move to the W side, as we got some news yesterday as Unrivaled had player availabilities. Basically three players per team, et cetera, et cetera. We got to hear from Satu Sabli yesterday, and a question was posed. I think it was Madeline Kennedy posed a question about Satu's free agency, and Satu Sabli said succinctly, you know, I've already alerted Dallas that I've played my last game there. We're going to work together to find my new home. And I was like, oh.
Didn't she already alert us?
I mean.
No, I'm the season. Didn't she make a video before? Like, hey, I'm about to be a free agent, y'all.
Not that I had seen.
You didn't see that one?
No, I didn't. Oh. So, yeah, I'll take the L on that. So, like, that was something that I just kind of baked in. Like, this very much felt like Dallas core Satu, and then Satu tries to make her way out. But it was just interesting for me to literally just hear her say flat out, like, nah, I played my last game in Dallas. So I'm excited for my new opportunity. It's like, oh, okay, I just wasn't expecting that during Unrivaled availability. Follow-up question, hey, how you feel about playing with your sister, Niara? It's like, yeah, I'd love to do that in the future. It's like, okay, well, seeds planted. I guess we will see. Steve, is this just Satu to the Liberty? Is that just all this is?
No.
Okay.
It's not automatic. If the Indiana Fever knock on the door, that can get interesting. Depends on A, where Satu kind of wants to land, B, what Dallas can get offer-wise. They've got to work together to a degree. There's been debate on leverage, but it's very clear that some things are going to have to go down, if that makes sense. Wink, wink, nudge, nudge. I guess it's, I think Indiana's an interesting one. I think, I don't know about Golden State, but maybe. They don't sleep on the Aces if they wanted to.
Yeah. I guess for me, like, that this has to be a core plus trade situation, I think is where it gets interesting. I think, I guess starting with the Liberty, there's the obvious connection there with Niara Sovli, and she played with Sabrina Ionescu. They are now on the same unrivaled team, which is funny in and of itself. So that very much feels like the most natural landing spot, the natural end to this. And to the Liberty's credit, even after losing Kayla Thornton in the expansion draft, like, they do still just have a bunch of wings that they can move to entice. They have their first round pick this year. I don't know if they're going to have much use for that first round pick considering what the rest of the roster is. And ultimately, if Satu Sabli is on the table, like, I'm probably taking that over a late first round pick with all due respect. I guess from New York's perspective, I'm curious to see like what negotiating is going to look like, because naturally, if Satu's on the table and we can get her without giving up anyone in our like top five or top six in the rotation, we want to do that. If Dallas is like, absolutely not, and we have other suitors, to your point, Indiana may throw their hat in the ring, the Aces may throw their hat in the ring, Seattle may throw their hat in the ring, et cetera. How willing is New York to come up on their offer? And what does that look like? Does that become Bonai Jelani Hamilton? Does that become Leonie Feverish? Again, players that New York, in a perfect world, would not want to give up at all. Like, you want to add Satu to all of that wing talent. But are they willing to do that? I'm just curious to see what that's going to look like.
I have no comment. Do you think they're willing to?
I would say yes. At the end of the day, that is, what, Satu's 26, 27? A clear all-W talent when she's healthy? That just doesn't happen every year. So it feels like a unique opportunity to add a star talent without giving up a star in return. I think they ultimately get there if they have to. Like, I would imagine they try to tap the Bonai Jelani Hamilton button first, if they can. If it becomes like her or Leonie Feverish, like, I think Lady is, I think, a better player in a vacuum, but Leonie younger, we just saw what she did all season long, but particularly in that postseason run, cost control contract, et cetera. So I would imagine if New York had to choose between the two, it's probably Bonai that would be going to Dallas, or maybe a third team if they really try to expand this out. But I think ultimately they say yes for Satu.
What about the Lynx?
I would love the Lynx fit. You talk about team versatility, and now you have Satu and Nafisa Collier in the same front court. I'd have a lot of fun with that. And like something that we've talked about, you know, earlier in the W offseason, just keeping tabs on, hey, what is the deal with Diamond Miller in particular? Because they made that run largely without her, despite, you know, former number two pick, incredible talent, high potential, et cetera. Is it Diamond plus something? You know, Diamond plus other salary, maybe another pick or two to get Satu in the building, and you add to that core. And you're rolling out Courtney Williams, Kayla McBride, Satu, Nafisa Collier, Lana Smith. Hey, that's absolutely an enticing spot, in my opinion. I guess the other thing is just, what is Dallas going to be prioritizing in a deal like this? Do they want another star? Because they do still have a star in their own in Arike. So I don't think they want to just completely punt on a season.
Well, they also have a very high pick. Wink, yeah. Wink, nudge, nudge. So
they sure do. So I don't think this is an easy, hey, we're just trying to be bad for another year.
No, I don't think they're trying to be bad for another year. Not with the way they were talking about trying to make things different in that press conference. Mm-hmm. Does Golden State make a splash?
I don't doubt that they're going to want to. I guess for me, is since Satu also has to at least be mostly okay with the spot, like, I don't know if that's the Satu spot.
Just wondering, hey, you know, face the franchise. Throwing it out there.
No, I don't think that's like a bad thing to throw out. I guess I'm just trying to like One, is that just, hey, here's the Golden State has, I think, the five pick. Like, here's the five pick and something. Here you go. And then from there, they just go full flight ahead into free agency. Like, we have Satu. Let's really build this out. We have all the money to throw. Like, if they can convince Satu, that becomes really, they really become players in free agency, I would imagine. They're going to try to be that anyway, but if you can just come in with, we have a legit star in the building already. Here's the new franchise. Here's our new coach that's respected league-wide. Here are these awesome facilities, which, talk about some of the things that came out unrivaled. Like, Alyssa Thomas once again throwing out the, hey, we ain't got these facilities in Connecticut. This is obviously a thing that matters to players. So, I mean, hey, Golden State should absolutely try to make the splash. I'll say that much. But I would imagine, again, Liberty's probably going to be at the top of the Satu list. No reporting here, but that just feels like reading tea leaves. New York feels like at the top of the list from there. Minnesota, again, makes sense. Indiana makes sense. The Aces, if you ask me, like, hey, they get more size. That's cool. I do wonder how heavily they're going to go into this, into the Satu sweepstakes. But from a talent perspective, it certainly would make some sense. Especially if you are looking for, I guess that leads to a different Aces question for me. Like, what type of partner are they prioritizing alongside Asia? Because they have one at the center. They've had Kia Stokes. You saw Megan Gustafson last year. Obviously, the year before that, they had Candace, and she was out. Got to see some Kayla George alongside Asia, et cetera, et cetera. Asia plus Alicia Clark has been very good, but Alicia Clark not as good as she was the previous season, but still productive, obviously. I do wonder, do they want a bigger body next to Asia still, primarily, or do they want to find versatile four and lean further into those kind of alignments? If it's the latter, then I would imagine the interest level goes up even higher for Satu for very obvious reasons. If they do prioritize the center spot and ultimately just kind of keeping their core four together, then I can see them saying, hey, Satu's cool. We can't do that without rounding out the rest of the roster like we want to. So let's prioritize finding the right big next to Asia, trying to get a little bit more younger, a little younger slash productive on the bench. And we just trust a full offseason with Chelsea Gray, Jackie Young getting completely right, Kelsey Plum getting completely right as she dealt with a lot off the floor. And I think we just come back with that vengeance of losing in the second round. So, like, I think the Aces can really play it either way. That's the benefit of having that kind of top four headlined by the MVP, but that gets fun. Is there a dark horse for you outside of Golden State?
Minnesota was the one for me.
Minnesota's the one. Okay. I guess dark horse for me, like, I, does Atlanta try to make a splash?
I don't think so.
Two big three?
I don't think so. I don't think so.
All right, we can leave.
Dream on.
Dream on. I'm sorry to the Dream fans listening. That's tough. Okay. Well, we'll continue to monitor that as a core designations and offer sheets go out starting Saturday. I think it's the 11th through the 17th are the dates. So we're about to start getting those news nuggets soon. Again, we'll see. Satu likely to get the core, if I had to guess. Brianna Stewart we're probably going to get the core designation. I would imagine Alyssa Thomas gets the core designation. If we're talking about restricted free agent offer sheets, Dejanay Carrington obviously going to get one for Connecticut. And she's really going to have an interesting free agency to track. Because we're in a year where everyone wants the one-year deal, like, I don't think it's the same risk of someone throwing like a three-year, like, near max at Dejanay. But they can still go 1 year high enough to make that interesting for Connecticut. So we'll curious to see what that part looks like. But I'm excited for W free agency. Satu obviously going to be a pretty big domino to fall in this year's offseason. And from there, we can move into the Dunker Spot mailbag. Once again, if you have basketball questions at any time, you can email us at dunkerspot@yahoo.com. That is dunkerspot@yahoo.com. First question going to come from Steven, who says, hey, Nikias and Steve, big fan of the show from Sydney, Australia. There we go. Love the vibe and depth of your conversations. My question is, do I watch too much Celtics? You can take the boy out the Boston suburbs, etc. Or are players taking fewer floaters and runners than they were 3 or 4 years ago? Even taking into account the increase in threes, it seems like I'm seeing more players opting for one-legged fadeaways or whatever you call the Jalen Brunson thing, where you do a half spin into an up fake and try to get fouled once they've gotten into the lane rather than floating it up. Have either of you guys noticed this, or am I recognizing patterns that don't exist? If this is a real trend, what do you think is driving it? Is it a recognition from offenses that floaters are less efficient than other close-range shots, or has defense changed in a way that has made the floater harder? My one thought is maybe more help and less two-on-two straight-up drop is a factor, but that's entirely because you guys have mentioned it a bunch. Thanks so much for reading this far. I love the show and would love to hear what you guys think.
This is the Nikias Duncan Bowl right here. You are the floater man.
Hashtag floater gang.
Every year on this podcast, you've asked for a different player of a star nature to shoot more floaters. I think you bet Jason Tatum to do it. I don't know who else is on the list. But this is entirely, and I mean 1,000% up your alley. Before I cede the space to you, floater man, I would probably mention, I think it can get a little tricky to set up sometimes. It's a little harder to get to it every single time because it's not the same high pick and roll. You're automatically going to be snaking and getting right back to it, or you're going to keep your man behind and trying to get to it. You know, more teams are actually going, like, it feels like eye test wise, you're seeing more unders this year at times, just sprinkling it. Hey, we're just going to go under this. That's fine. Okay. So you're not going to get to a floater there. If there's two on the ball, it's pretty hard to get to a floater there. So it might just be the desire to go to drive and kick, and that might change things. But again, I will cede to the floater expert, Nikias Duncan.
The floater expert is crazy. Well, first, I'm trying to like pull up the under stats for the last 5 years to see if the rate is going up or down. So while that loads, I can get into my floater spiel. One, I really appreciate this question. I love when we get stuff like this that we can just really sink our teeth into. To start to directly answer the question, I don't think it is a matter of teams taking fewer floaters. I think because you are watching a bunch of Boston and Boston is dead last in the NBA in floaters per game, it is very much a, hey, I'm just not seeing a lot of these. So I think that's kind of where the thought comes from. Again, just looking up the numbers on floaters per second spectrum is 2.9 per game for Boston, which is easily last. Teams are taking about 6 per game against Boston, which is about the 10th most. But overall, like, that's still not a lot of floaters that you're seeing. In terms of the per game rate league-wide, going back to Second Spectrum's database in 2013-14, it was 8.8 floaters per game in 13-14. Then the following year, 9.3. The next year, 9.6. The following year, 9.6 again. The following year, 10.3. The next year, 11 per game. Then 11.6 per game, 11.4 per game. So we get a little bit of a dip. 12.1 per game is 11.8 last year. We're back up to 12.1 this year. So just in general, the floater rate has actually gone up over the past 10 years on a per game basis. But again, with Boston specifically, they just do not take. They're taking three pretty much as the rise of threes and ultimately getting to the rim. That's why you're not seeing a lot of that. Steve is right. I have asked for the efficiency for Jason Tatum's floater to improve. Just in general, his comfort in the middle of the floor, you'd like to see a little bit better. That has gotten better. So kudos to Jason Tatum. So floaters are still being taken at a pretty high level. I would say what's interesting to me is I was digging into the numbers earlier today, like the efficiency on floaters technically up 2013-14. It was at 38% league wide. It's at 44.1% this year. But over the last three seasons, we have seen a consistent dip in floater efficiency. So if you want to track that part, it's interesting. Steve, I also have some trivia prepared for you. I sure do.
Did you get all your floater notes out? Because Steven, I want you to know, you made Nikias's day. We are recording on a Friday morning. It's early, and I can guarantee Nikias has spent an hour and a half this morning pouring through this floater data. And if you notice, listeners, the difference in Nikias's tone when we went from the Cleveland segment to Satu to this, he's refound his joy. So let's give a salute to Steven. We always do the good things for people in the world.
That is crazy. I would say just to bounce off of like your coverage point, again, because floaters are up. But I think when you see some pockets where you would normally see a floater, but now it's like a pickup and a pivot, et cetera, I think because more teams are comfortable going into late switches, the general pocket that a player is used to having against drop and taking two or three dribbles and getting right into it is now becoming, oh, let me drag this out to guarantee that this is a switch. And now I can either attack one-on-one from here. And I would imagine it's a little bit more difficult to just straight line drive against a big in an ISO setting and get into a floater specifically. Or, hey, now there's a smaller player defending my bigger player. Let's see if we get the ball to him. And so I think in those moments, you're seeing like the frequency of floater attempts go down. But like overall, again, floater rate has risen overall the last 10 years. So I think that'd be my only other big note there before we get into some floater trivia that I think you would get a kick out of. Did you have anything else you wanted to add on that front?
No, great question. This did exactly what it needed to do.
There we go. Steve, so first, there are 8 players that have taken at least 70 floaters so far this year for a second spectrum. Can you name them?
Trae Young.
Trae Young is on the list. He's taken 98 and he's only converted 42% of those.
Jalen Brunson.
Jalen Brunson is second, 129 taken, 52.7% on those.
Darius Garland.
Darius Garland also on the list. He's taken 71. He has converted 62% of those.
Are there any bigs on this list?
There is a big on the list.
Is Tyrese Maxey on this list?
Tyrese Maxey not on the list.
Is Cade Cunningham on this list?
Cade Cunningham not on the list.
Donovan Mitchell.
Donovan Mitchell not on the list.
James Harden.
James Harden not on the list.
See, we're going to run to the issue. I'm going to forget who I already said yes to, so I got to write this down real quick.
Okay. You have Jalen Brunson, you have Trae Young, and you have Darius Garland. So you have 5 more to get.
Are there any Washington Wizards or like people on this list?
Or like? Now, what does that mean? There are no Wizards.
Okay.
If you're asking if there are players on like bad teams, there is one.
Austin, Tyrese Haliburton?
Tyrese Haliburton close, but not on the list.
That's unfair. Austin Reeves?
Austin Reeves not on the list.
Jokic?
Jokic not on the list.
De'Aaron Fox?
De'Aaron Fox is on the list. He's taken 89. He has converted 52.8% of those.
All right, so I've gotten 4 now.
Yes.
We started hot, and now we're struggling a little bit. So I'm sure the listeners are screaming out a name at me right now. I do apologize. Damian Lillard?
Damian Lillard not on the list.
This is deeply unfortunate. Did I already say Tyler Hero?
You have not said Tyler Hero, but he is not on the list.
Jaren Jackson Jr.
Jaren Jackson Jr. is number 1 on the list with 143. He has converted 50.4% of those.
That's a big one. It's a big get right there. I have 3 more.
Yes.
No idea where I'm going to get that from. Goodness gracious.
I would imagine the listeners are still yelling.
There's probably a very obvious one. I've gone way past like my brain power after I start out hot. Well, it's not going to be a Celtic.
Sure, right?
You know what? Let's go outside the box. Is Scoot Henderson on this list?
He is not.
Dang, you said that so quick. Ty Jerome?
Ty Jerome not on the list.
Okay, I've gone too far deep. Let's relax a little bit. Anthony Edwards?
Anthony Edwards not on the list.
And I've nailed the only big that's on there, right? Kyrie? Did I already say Kyrie?
You haven't said Kyrie, but he's not on the list.
Norm Powell?
No.
RJ Barrett?
No.
Jordan Poole?
No. I literally said there's no Wizards, and you come in with Jordan Poole.
Brother, I'm in the deep here. What do you want from me? Bradley Beal?
No.
Jaden Ivey?
No.
Man, this is getting disgusting. Can I get a hint? I got 5 of these.
The hint song.
Oh, Sabrina Carpenter.
I will turn off my microphone. You hooligan.
I'm trying not to tap here. I'm trying to get to 6. Jalen Williams?
No.
Okay, I don't like the veracity of these no's, pal. All right.
Hand on shoulder. I am so sorry to tell you that your guess was incorrect.
Thank you. Keep trying. It's a little better. Oh, folks, I tried. I'm a tap. Who are the last three?
All right. In order of the volume that you are missing, with 98 floaters on 47% efficiency, LaMelo Ball.
How did Jesus Christ?
literal floater game guy. With 83, converting 54% of those, Tyus Jones.
Okay. Okay. That's on the use.
That's literally what he does. And the final one, 75 floaters attempted, 44% of those. And I think as I say this name, you will then just immediately get the visual of some of the ones that he takes that would explain some of the efficiency. Dyson Daniels.
I don't think that counts. Like, I know it does, but I don't think it does. shoot a mid-range jumper. Put your other foot down, buddy.
So those are your 8 with 70. Another question that I have for you. There are three players that have taken at least 50 floaters and have converted at least 60% of them. You have already named one of the players, so you should get one of the three off rip.
That's you're overrating it. I think you should be able to. Since I've already guessed it, you should be able to give me that one.
Okay, fine. Well, one of them is Darius Garland.
Thank you. All right. One for
three. He's on the first list.
One for three. So wait, what was the category again?
Players that have taken 50 and have made at least 60% of them.
Are any bigs on this list?
Yes, the other two are bigs.
Jokic?
Yes, Jokic just won. 58, he's converted 63.8% of them.
Cat?
No.
Wimby?
No.
Anthony Davis?
No.
Damn.
Not with that. I'm driving left, getting to that right hand anyway. All due respect.
Domantas Sabonis.
That, when have you seen him take a float? No.
Yes. Pop.
Gosh darn it.
That's all I wanted from that. Shingun?
No.
Is this Zubac?
It is not, but that would have been incredibly funny.
No, it's not Bam this year. No offense.
Sure ain't.
This is not Jared Allen or Evan Mobley, right?
No.
Oh. Tap.
Okay. Nikola Vucevic, who's taken 54.
How did I not? God!
Converted 68.5% of his floaters. Per second spectrum. I have one more, but I don't even know if I want to put you through that.
No, man, go ahead, man. This is for the, this is for the listeners' enjoyment.
All right, so sticking with the 50 floaters attempted, the bottom three in floater field goal percentage. And the hint that I will give you is that you have said two of these names in this segment.
I've said many names in this segment. This is not going to help me.
That's deeply unfortunate.
Are these guards or bigs?
These are guards.
James Harden?
No.
I don't know.
Well, these are perimeter players, I should say.
I don't know. Give me the names.
The quick. All right. Well, because it's 30 players that have taken at least 50. So number 28 on the list, Jalen Williams at 34.6%. Number 29 on the list, Kyrie Irving at 33.9%, which is not anything that I had on my bingo card. And number 30 on the list, Anthony Simons at 32.7%. And that concludes your floater trivia for today's podcast. Thank you, Steven. Thank you, Steve. Thank y'all for participating.
That was the most Steve thing ever to get Jaren Jackson Jr., but not LaMelo Ball and Tyus Jones.
Unbelievable. I say a hit song and you come with Sabrina Carpenter.
Does she not make bangers?
Does she play basketball in the NBA?
You don't know that.
Our next question. Unbelievable. See, if this was a YouTube episode, this would just be like Sabrina Carpenter Photoshop, her taking the floater. Oh, gosh. Anyway,
let's go to our next question.
Our next question.
That really threw you for a loop.
Yeah, why did you say that? Someone isn't going to swerve, bend that corner. But anyway.
Whoa.
Dear pal, Roby says, hey, fellas, after watching a few recent Miami Heat games, I've become concerned with Bam Adebayo's offense. I know that progression isn't linear and Tyler's emergence slash heavier workload may be affecting everyone on the team differently, but Bam is missing shots from spots he was confident in last year, spots Spo is actively running offense to get him to. His touch around the basket has never been great, but appears even worse lately. His midi is too heavily relied upon and inefficient, also going glass at odd times and angles. Thank you for that one, Roby. What factors do you think are most responsible for the regression, and what do he and Spo try to course correct? Thanks for taking my question, and keep spreading the good word of basketball.
I mean, I think something I've been looking at with Bam this year is just how is his shot diet affected by the shift in, hey, I'm also mixing in more threes. Mm-hmm. Like, I remember 2.6 three-point attempts. That's a career high. He had taken a total of 104 threes in his career. He's taken 92 this year, and he had made 23 in his entire career. He's made 26 this year. And so the biggest thing is the distribution. Less of his field goal attempts are in the restricted area, going from 30.8% last year to 25.1% this year. Less of his shots are in the mid-range this year. So it's about 18.6 last year. It's about 12.3, shooting 45% from mid-range, according to the league's data. The problem is, in the paint, non-restricted area, not having a good time. Shooting about 41%. It was like 50 last year. And so a huge bulk of his shots are still there. So if you're missing like 2 to 3 a game, it's going to have an impact. And so I think the threes have made things a little different. He's not finishing some of those in the paint floater little runner shots. And he's not necessarily spamming mid-range to the effect that we've seen before, to where I'm gonna self-create, hit this pull-up, type beat. And I think it's part of the evolution for Miami as far as, one, moving him across the board, but also trying to find a functionality with what Tyler's doing and making sure everyone else gets going. And I just think it's more just, can he make some of those in-between shots? And I think it's also a reaction to, even if you look at the Utah game last night, teams rotate to Bam now. Like, it's not the same, hey, I'm just open. Like, my slip is going to get a person to come as far as they possibly can to meet me in a way that we haven't necessarily seen before. Which, again, the oddest thing about the Miami Heat, they do something that earns you more attention paid to what you're doing, and it just doesn't help them all the time. Like, you know what I mean? Like, it's like, this should be a good thing. And then it's like, wait, why is this not happening the same way? But also think, like, how many transition opportunities is he getting? How many great pick and roll partners does he have right now? How are teams defending a lot of the guards or wings that are going to be in actions with him, whether it's a handoff or a pick and roll? How many times are they just getting unders? And so, hey, you got to go somewhere else now. Mm-hmm. That part, I think, is where it gets affected. But I think it's something that I know Spo is always conscious of. So I don't necessarily worry about to the same degree. I think they're just trying to move him across the board. Like, how many times you see Bam spaced this year in the corner? Not just because he's shooting threes, but because, hey, we want to open up the floor a little bit. You can mix these in, but that's going to take you away from some of the normal spots that you're in every single day. So that's probably where my mind goes. What say you?
I got you. Like, I think with the offense kind of reorienting, you mentioned the spacing point. That's probably the biggest thing for him. Like, he's taking more threes. He is just on the perimeter more. And like, something that I brought up earlier in the pod season was Miami leaning even further into setting off ball screens and setting flares and setting pin ins to generate more catch and shoot threes. And so, like, Bam is naturally a part of that. And so that takes him away from the basket. Remember someone tweeted out the stat, I want to say earlier this week, about like his average shot distance. I can pull that back up really quickly. Yeah, average shot distance is 10.8 feet this year. Like, naturally, when you're just taking threes when you haven't before, that's going to influence that number. But even in terms of the percentage of looks that are coming, like, pretty much all of it inside the arc stuff is down from last year in terms of the percentage of shots that are coming in those specific ranges. So that's down. He isn't getting assisted as much. You mentioned the pick and roll partner. Like, I think this is where the Heat missed Kyle Lowry. He was the best passer, best entry passer, and probably the most intentional person on the roster about, nah, Bam, you're getting the ball. Like, one of the things that popped early on in the Kyle Lowry stint was pick and roll. Maybe it's a switch. We're giving Bam the ball. Bam kicks it back out because he's just used to doing that. And Kyle Lowry very demonstrably, no. Re-entry. Go attack, big fella. And I don't think they have that. I think Tyler Hero, like the pick and roll between him and Bam, like they've generally been good throughout their 10 years together. But where they're setting some of these screens for Tyler and Tyler now leaning into more pull-up threes, I think some of the pockets that Bam would normally have to take a dribble or two and either get all the way downhill for one of his drives or get into one of those short jumpers for him, they are becoming Tyler pull-up threes. And I think that's an overall benefit for the offense. And we've seen that with Tyler, especially at the level that he's hitting these pull-up threes. But like some of the more obvious opportunities are becoming those shots instead of Bam getting the ball. And in terms of the Bam usage itself, like you mentioned the spacing, when he does get these touches, it's not to like eyeballing it and didn't feel like he's getting the same intentional let screen for Bam to get him a touch close to the basket. And then as you were talking, I quickly looked up a stat and nearly lost my mind when I saw it. Steve, how many cross screens do you think Bam has gotten this year?
I'm not sure. How many?
He's gotten 22.
Ah, I see.
He has gotten 22 cross screens this year. It was 170 last year. It was 201 the year before that. Like that part has been completely removed, is essentially been removed from the offense. And a part of that is when you had those cross screens for Bam, guess who was screening for him? Kyle Lowry. Because he's willing to do it, he's good at it, and you can create some mismatches or at least create a little bit of confusion for Bam to catch it and attack quick. If you don't have that kind of guard screener, and ultimately you're just not doing it, period, Bam may get a touch around the left elbow, but now it's just you just catch the ball, we clear out, and you can attack an ISO. I think that also boils down to a lower number of his baskets are being assisted this year. Lowest of his career to this point. There are shots that Bam gets that he just needs to make because he's shown he's good enough to make them. Another chunk of this is, again, like some of the reorientative offense around Tyler Hero, and he's been good enough to warrant that this year. So Bam just has to adjust on that front. Another part of it is just they're just not helping him in some aspects. Like something as simple as cross screen underneath, we can go inverted, we can get you a catch 7 feet from the basket. So even if you are just taking a turnaround jumper, it's an easier jumper for you. Or now you can get into pump, face up, jab step, attack, get into some of those rip throughs that he's good at. He's historically been a big that has a pretty high free throw rate. You can get some of those looks. And now a missed jumper that dings the field goal percentage is now a field goal attempt that doesn't count in the box score because these are two free throws. And like enough of those can just balance out the actual efficiency number for him. I think everyone's at fault, is probably too strong of a word, but like for the purposes of this conversation, I think everyone's at fault for what's happened with Bam's offense this year. He has to be better. He has to adjust some of his game. And I think from a play calling perspective and just a decision-making perspective from the guards, like we talked about Tyler Hero, the Rozier-Bam pick and rolls have been Terry Rozier-Bam pick and rolls to where Rozier either misses Bam or he's hitting him on the pocket too early. And like, I don't think Terry Rozier makes Bam's life easier when Terry's on the ball. Now, we're talking about some of the off-ball screens Bam setting for Terry Rozier as he's a very good catch-and-shoot threat. Like, that relationship obviously is a more positive one. But, like, they haven't made Bam's life easier. And that's before getting into just the general defensive workload that Bam has every year. So, I think it's a little bit of everything. Like, I don't think Bam is a cooked product offensively or anything like that. But I think it is like sometimes players just have down years sometimes. So there is an element of that. But so much has changed. And I don't think enough is being done to generate easier looks for him. Because it's funny that this scoring season is happening in a year where Bam's averaging darn near 5 assists a game. And the turnovers are down for him. So he's still coming to a bunch defensively. He's still helping open up the offense for others, both as a handoff threat, some of the drives for him, and as an off-ball screener. But with him as a scorer, it's here you go. On top of what you mentioned, we're also just shading more attention to Bam on some of these short roll looks. And again, back to Bam, he has to do a better job of dealing with those. There have been a lot of catch, smaller player rotates to him, and he's picking the ball up and pump faking, et cetera. It's like, no, those are opportunities for you to just go up strong because you are Bam and you are athletic And while the touch isn't great, it's still good enough for you to finish a floater over a rotating small defender. So I, you know, it's year one of all of this. So again, I don't think he's cooked. That's not what I'm going to say. But I think that's where all of that kind of comes together. He's got to be better, and the Heat have to be better in helping him, I think is ultimately where I land. So I guess the answer to what do they try to do to course correct, let run more off-ball stuff for Bam would be probably the number one thing I point out. It doesn't even have to be a cross screen. General down screen. Have Haywood Highsmith screen for Bam before he goes into a pick and roll with Tyler. Get the defense off, you know, off kilter. So now if you do get Tyler driving, it's a cleaner pocket for Bam to roll into, and it's a cleaner catch for him on that pocket since they're already recovering, trying to switch and deal with the drive, et cetera. Like, stuff like that is a way to generate easier opportunities for Bam. And from there, if he still misses a shot, hey, big fella, all-star, max contract, man, you got to make your shots. And we can just have that conversation. But I don't think enough's being done to help him either. So very long-winded answer, my apologies, but that's where I'm at with the Bam Adebayo offense experience at the very least. Smile, sparkle, sparkle. Steve, do you have any closing thoughts before we before we move?
No.
Okay, fair enough. Well, next one going to come from Christian, who says, hi, Nikias and Steve. Happy New Year. Thank you. Something that has always stood out to me about NBA basketball is the atmosphere in the arenas. When the stakes are high, nothing is more exciting than hearing the crowd roar in celebration or go silent after a dagger. I believe that audio and visual effects play a big part in adding to this atmosphere, and I wonder how much these things impact the play, effort, and mentality of players and coaches during the game. Of course, there are the bright lights and live organ of MSG, but what about teams like the Thunder and Sixers, which have DJs who constantly play music on both ends of the ball? Is it possible that a smooth instrumental can get an offensive player into rhythm on their dribble moves and shot, or that a steady defense chant can get a team organized on the side of the floor? I don't think it's a coincidence that some of the best teams in the league also have the best atmospheres.
Yeah, there's no coincidence, but I mean, it's every atmosphere is different. Every matchups are different. Days are different. Vibes are different. There's plenty of times where you hear the defense with no defense chant behind it. But no disrespect, I worked in the Barclays Center for 2 years. You could watch a Nets game right now and hear them do the dun, dun, and no one says anything.
At least some nice drums.
So, I mean, you know, every team has a let's go, whoever they are.
And Cavs,
they're all there. So, I mean, they're going to try and get the environment going, put on a show. I think you kind of have to earn the atmosphere, but we've seen some of the best ones. We've seen Minnesota go off, Cleveland. It just kind of ebbs and flows these days. So, yes, I think it's key, but I don't think there's, like, one specific way to get to it. And I might just be numb to it because I've watched entirely too much basketball. And so I just – it's just background noise to me. So I don't really think about it until, oh, wow, it's time to think about how lit this atmosphere or this stadium is.
Mm-hmm. So I have a question for you as you mentioned, like, you're someone that has literally worked in the league. And I will preface this by saying this could just be a incredibly stupid question. And I am okay if you say, hey, Dekai, that is an incredibly stupid question. But, like, in terms of the volume of, you know, some of the arena music or some of the chants, et cetera, like, are there any conversations between, like, the op staff and, like, maybe not coaching staff, but you get what I mean? Because I would imagine, like, on defense specifically, like, you want to be able to communicate and call out things, et cetera, et cetera. So is there, like, a you can be loud, but can you, like, do you test these things in the offseason to see, like, what the appropriate volume is to make sure you can still build that atmosphere versus drowning out what your team, what the home team is trying to accomplish?
No.
Okay.
Because here's the thing. In the playoffs, you can't. It doesn't matter. It's going to be loud anyways.
That's true. So there you go. See, this is why the preface is important. If you can see Steve's face right now, this is very much hashtag this neighbor. But yeah, curious, thought I had, so figured out that. There we go. And beyond that, like, pretty much echo what you say. You kind of have to build that kind of atmosphere overall. And so, like, I don't know. I do also find it hard to believe, like, a defense chant will make the defense want to play defense more. Like, it very much feels more like that's more for the fans than for the players themselves.
A really strong defense chant can get you going, especially if you're on a run and the team is, yeah, it can give you a mental attribute boost. That's not a bad thing at all. It's not gonna do it every single time, but if you're getting stops, locking up, it can boost you a little bit.
Okay. I guess the other question I would ask, more jokingly than anything, is, as the Sixers have a DJ, so like, do they just play the song for Paul George on ball reps? Should they do that? Would that turn his season around? Got him. Steve has turned off his camera, bro. Didn't you know? But anyway, we can now move to the next question. It's going to come from Anthony, who says, "Dear Nikias, Steve, and Dunker Nation, my friend and I were having a discussion on how poor basketball shoes once were in our sport. Playing every day and competing at a high level must have been so painful over time. After reviewing the timeline of basketball shoe evolution, I noticed it roughly correlated with the shift in the NBA where guards became more of a focal point. Air Jordans in the 80s and the Hyperdunks in the 2000s. We thought about how tough it must have been to run and stop on a dime with old school Converse and shoes alike, especially for those players who had competitive advantages in speed and acceleration. Is it possible big men had some advantage over smaller, quicker players since their size and strength weren't limited by their shoes as much as the guards were? Is the old adage of your best player can't be a guard only true because we weren't able to see the full athletic potential of smaller players until basketball shoes evolved? What say you?"
I mean, Spud Webb won the dunk contest in some Pony City Wings. So, I mean.
Can we talk about that dunk? Actually, never mind. That's a different thought. But right, continue.
What do you mean, can we talk about that dunk contest? No. We're going to bring everything else to a halt. What do you mean?
There's a whole lot of, it's just a whole lot of double pump in that contest, just as a concept. It's not necessarily Spud commentary. It was just a whole lot of toss, reverse double pump, 50. And then toss, reverse double pump, but in yellow, 50. Go ahead, dude. I'm listening. Go ahead. I didn't mean to cut you off.
It was 1986. What do you want?
It sure was.
I wasn't even alive. They just appreciated what they had.
No, they. Listen, it was very good for the era. It's just, you know. Go ahead. I've hijacked enough of this segment.
I think the thing for me is, I think it's an interesting theory. I think those shoes were what they were. And the other thing is there were so many different shoes, I feel like, in the 80s and 90s. Like, go look up what Clyde Drexler was wearing. So I think everyone kind of found their comfort. Technology obviously helps now. But you could argue, hey, there was way more ankle support in some of them big, clunky concrete shoes than they have these days, if you wanted to. So I would say, I don't think it necessarily held the guards back. I know it made it a little bit tougher at times, but they all eventually found what worked for them to a degree. And bigs were a little bit slower anyway, so it was a little different. It was rough either way, I felt like. I mean, I remember my freshman year of high school, I tried out. I was wearing the low Adidases with the three stripes just because it fit my foot. But it was like my ankle started to hurt, and I was like, well, I can't do this anymore.
Oh, no. We don't want those. Like, I guess to try to answer the question in two parts, like, I agree that I think it's an obvious agree that we probably didn't see the full athletic potential of some of, not just the guards, I think of everyone, because of what some of the shoe stability was back in like the 70s and 80s and even partly of the 90s. So I think that part's true. As far as like bigs having the advantage over smaller guards, like, I don't know if I can get to that part. Like, I can see where the guards may be hindered like 2 or 3%, but like the bigs probably were as well. I guess the argument, now that I think about this live, like, is it a higher degree of difficulty for the guards as they already kind of have to operate in cramped spaces because of what the spacing was and what the 3-point emphasis or lack thereof was back then? Like, it's probably more important to get that short area burst and have that short area quickness. And if you couldn't really, like, plant to full capacity because of the shoes, like, that's probably a layer that I didn't consider as much. And Biggs probably had to, you know, defensively anyway, just had to navigate less space. So I guess in, like, those specific contexts, Biggs would have a little bit more of an advantage because they part towards the rim, wouldn't get baked as much. You could challenge and block more shots, et cetera. So I guess within that lens, yes. But, like, overall, like, you're all on the court at the end of the day. And, like, it's not like the bigs had super advanced shoes and the guards didn't. So I still kind of lean on everyone kind of was at a disadvantage compared to the shoe and the shoes and the technology that we have now. But this is a question that it made me think a little bit more than I anticipated. So I do appreciate this one. Because my base thought heading into reading this question was just the shoes weren't great. They were playing in Converse. This doesn't seem healthy. And that was just kind of the depth of my my thought on the matter. But, like, now thinking about the specific advantages and disadvantages, like, huh, there's probably a little bit more here. I can understand how you and your friend fell into this rabbit hole of thought. So good stuff for y'all. Steve, do you have anything else before we move?
Nah.
Okay. Fair enough. Next one going to come from Chibuzo. So if I said that incorrectly, you have permission to yell at me. It says, hi, Dunker Spot. If you are able, could you please provide more feedback on the discussion around Jalen Williams, LeBron James, and Jalen Johnson? More specifically, why is Jalen Williams rated above LeBron James? For the season, LBJ is averaging more points, rebounds, and assists than Jalen Williams on better shooting splits. So as I was going back through the archives here, my initial thought was like, oh, this must be all-star coded. Now, I looked at my notes. I was like, well, no, I had LeBron and Jalen on the team. And I was like, wait, where did Jalen Johnson come from? Because he was like a replacement for Franz for me. But, like, how did that come? And then I was like, oh, this is the New Year's Eve episode when you tossed the free throw about those three. You asked me to rank their seasons. And that was Jalen, LeBron, then Jalen. Well, Jalen Williams, then LeBron, then Jalen Johnson for me. And I was like, oh, okay. Which then rendered some of my notes useless because I had, like, hey, notes since the pod, but it was from the week before and not the New Year's Eve pod. So, like, I'll still say those, but, like, I should have just did that a week ahead. But I guess to expand upon it a little bit, like, at the time, like, my argument was simply a lot of it was Jalen Williams has just been so much better and so much more important to a historic defense in OKC, especially in light of who they were missing in the front court, any times that he had to take. And so him putting up was like 22-5-5 plus all defense level defense, plus Thunder winning his minutes when he's on the floor and also winning the minutes when he's on the floor without Shea. So it's not just the Shea buffer. That's where I was kind of like, I feel better about the Jalen Williams season. Not that LeBron hasn't been very good, but you mentioned the production. Scoring, shooting well, finishing well, the assist and the playmaking just kind of is what it is. He's LeBron freaking James. I just have not loved the LeBron defense experience for most of this year. There have been moments. We have still seen some of the wild chase downs. We have seen some of the battling against centers on switches. But on a possession-by-possession basis, it's understandable because, you know, age, workload, et cetera. But just viewing what's happened on the floor, like, I haven't loved the general engagement level for LeBron defensively. And then, again, mentioning, you know, Jalen, OKC winning those Jalen minutes, even without Shea on the floor, you go to LeBron, that isn't the case for there. So, like, that was kind of the basis of why I felt better about the Jalen season versus the LeBron season. He's like, okay. I didn't say that. You got that, big dog.
Wasn't me.
That's true. Hey, that's true.
I had nothing to do with this. You did this.
That's true. No, that was all me. So that's why I had Jalen over LeBron. Now, funny enough, I guess going back to, like, the Christmas Eve pod, since that pod, I think the defense for Jalen has still been very good. LeBron's perked up a little bit. But just looking at the numbers since then, Jalen Williams, 17.6 points on 49.2 true shooting. And a lot of that is driven, I think, 67% from the line. That's uncharacteristic of him. Shooting 22% from three on nearly five attempts. The past couple weeks, not ideal at all. 5.4 rebounds, 5.9 assists, 1.7 steals, about half a block. Only two games above league average true shooting in that nine-game stretch for Jalen Williams. Not great. LeBron, on the other hand, 27 points on 67.8 true shooting. Mm-hmm. He is shooting 52.5% from three on nearly six attempts.
Uh-huh.
Seven boards, nine assists, about half a steal, 0.3 blocks in that stretch. So, like, it's certainly closer today than it was when we had that initial discussion. Like, I think I still would take the Jalen season overall. But at the very least, like, I don't, it's not as, duh, stamp, we out of here.
This man quadrupled down. That's Nakia. That's Nakia's Earl Duncan. That's not Steve Jones Jr. I'll tell you that much.
But no, like, it's a very funny time that we had that, those stretches going at the same time, right after like that pod in particular. But you know, again, to expand on the original point, like, that was where I was coming from when I listed those three, because that was just a free throw. We just kind of said it, but that was the reasoning behind that. Next one going to come from Dante. This was a blue sky question. Jalen Johnson is staying in Cali for the rest of the road trip to rehab his shoulder soreness. What will the Hawks miss from him, especially defensively? Well, I would say on the defensive end, we can start there first. I think the offense is pretty easy to parse through. Like, that is just a guy that can initiate offense, a guy that can finish plays for you, elite screening partner for Trey. Someone that can juice your transition attack, especially as he grabs boards and just kind of pushes and gets Atlanta to their stuff early. They're going to miss that finishing. Shooting wasn't great, but someone that could knock down spot up looks or knock down some pops whenever you want to do that. So offensive impact is there. Defensively, that's just a lot of size and athleticism for an Atlanta team that plays pretty aggressively defensively. And even when they go into someone like Deion Yek at the five lines, they want to switch more. Like, that is a guy that at the very least has the athleticism to slide with smaller players, even if it isn't always perfect. So on the year, 8.3 defensive rebounds, 1.5 steals, 1.1 blocks, per clean in the glass, a 111.6 defensive rating with Jalen Johnson on the floor, which is pretty much like a top five mark equivalent with him on the floor. A 122.2 with him off the floor, which it says a lot about who's replacing him in those minutes. But ultimately, if you're going to play that aggressively, you need someone when he's directly involved that can get the amount of deflections and on-ball steals that he can get. When you try to float that pass over, and he's just able to just deflect it, and then he's going the other way. And on the back end, if he's the low man, you need someone with that size and athleticism rotating down and challenging shots at the rim. Without him, the Hawks just don't have another guy with that specific intersection. And then especially that intersection of skills defensively, on top of, we trust you to initiate, we trust you to play finish, we trust you to screen for Trey, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So I think that's where you just miss all the gaps that he fills, to put it more simply. What say you, good sir?
Everything you said.
All right. Well, fair enough. Fair enough. With that, we can move to the next question. from Filipos, if I said that wrong, again, you have permission to yell at me. It might be quite early in his development, but how concerned should we be about opposing teams putting their bigs or worst perimeter defenders on Stephon Castle?
I'm not worried. I mean, the big part is not necessarily his issue, because I mean, we've seen them put bigs on Chris Paul too. Brook Lopez has guarded him. Nikola Jokic was guarding Chris Paul, which turned Chris Paul into a screener. That's mainly because you have an alien on your team. It's not necessarily Stephon Castle's bad. It's like, no, we want to take care of this. We'll handle that how we do. I think Castle's aggression and his drives will probably make things okay. But I wouldn't, like, sound the alarm right now, as this is going to be the bit that ends Stephon Castle. I think it's just a matchup thing that teams want to throw at the Spurs. And it's a positive thing in the big picture, because that means the Spurs are someone teams feel deemed, you know, worthy enough to game plan for right now.
Yeah. I like it. I'm not super concerned. Like, I think I would like for him to not be in the zone where teams dub him as the option to put the big on. Like, I agree with Steve that this is more of a Wimby thing. We want to put a wing on him, and we want our big to roam to kind of help at the rim and muck up spacing. But like, in a vacuum, because we talked about this early in the year with Jeremy Sohan getting that kind of coverage, even going to Utah. Like, I still remember Spurs Jazz game where it was Wimby, you're guarding Isaiah Collier. And then ultimately it turned into, okay, we are literally not guarding you at all. And so like, we are seeing that just perk up across the league, period. Like, go back a few years, like Boston with Robert Williams, like, we'll just stash you on the wing, et cetera, et cetera. And I don't even think Boston was the first team to do it. It was just loud, as they had like the best defense in the league at the time. So I would like for Stephon Castle to not be the one that gets the big ultimately. Like, I think teams are still going to commit to wing on Wimby for right now. But like, I don't know if I'm concerned long term, at least not right now. I think the only thing that gives me a little angst is because there were shooting questions about Stephon Castle coming into, you know, into the draft anyway. And so that he's kind of getting this in year one, it just kind of reinforces, yeah, we really don't think you can shoot. But Steve's mentioned the drives, like he does have the, the inside the arc craft to get to pull-ups and stuff like that. And so eventually I think he'll be able to punish things enough. And they view Stephon Castle as a screener too. So like, it's not like the Spurs don't have counters built in. So not super concerned long-term. I think it's more so reinforcing, yeah, this is a thing that was identified early on and teams are now putting you into their zone already. But I think he has plenty of time to beat that. Next question going to come from Eric, who says, hey guys, what do you think about the Grizzlies offense? Thinking Basketball on YouTube had a great video about how they don't set or use many screens. Their offense is based on space for the driver and four guys lifting, drifting, and cutting all in harmony to maintain the spacing. Curious on your takes, as it's always interesting seeing something new, especially when people think everyone runs the same actions.
You know my take. Shout out Thinking Basketball. I watched the Thunder last year and the year before that. I saw a lot of drive and kick and wings being cleared and cuts afterwards and then flow. So I'm intrigued to see your thoughts on this one, Big Dog.
Got you. Like, I think, one, just tell to the tape on the Grizzlies. Fifth in offense as of recording. 14th in half court offense. I think first in total drive, second in drives per game. Pretty efficient on those. To the point about not having many screens. They are dead last in pick and roll usage. About 33 picks per 100 possessions. That is easily the lowest mark in the league. Denver is currently 29th at 47.4. So that's about a 14 pick gap between 29th and 30th. They're also last in handoff usage, though Boston's kind of right there with them in that regard. So quick numbers on that front. As far as the Memphis offense, like, I've enjoyed it. Like, I think to Steve's point, they are not the first drive heavy offense. I think like the full floor shifting of it all is neat to me. It's something that I think after a Warriors win, funny enough, that something that Draymond talked about post game. It's like, hey, I think he called it weird specifically. It's like when one guy drives, the whole floor just kind of moves around. So it took us a minute to kind of get used to that. But ultimately, again, they were ultimately able to win that game. So like that part of it is interesting to me.
You mean cutting from the corner? Cutting from the corner and then going from the wing to the corner to fill that spot?
Yeah. The brow raises from Steve. I mean, so like that part's been fun. I think just through overall, I've just had fun with Memphis. It's just felt more free-flowing overall. And to a degree, it's kind of had to be in light of some of the injuries for them. So you've just seen, obviously, you know what Ja can do in the open floor. Desmaine's got better as a driver. We talked about the Jaren Grove on ball, but like Jalen Wills with catch and shoot and some of the attacks from him, Scottie Pippen Jr. driving, Santi Aldama leading fast breaks and initiating and driving, et cetera. So like, I guess for me, it's more, hey, everyone is kind of tasked with doing some stuff more than the specific offense itself. But like, I have enjoyed how intentional they've been about spacing and how they space and when they cut, et cetera. I think my question is what that looks like in a playoff setting, because I think even looking at the numbers of low pick and roll, low handoffs, et cetera, like, I don't think that's inherently bad. It is rather extreme on the pick and roll front, but I don't think that's inherently bad. I guess what raises my brow is y'all are at the bottom in both, and y'all are also like towards the bottom in efficiency. Like, I would at least prefer, we don't do it often, but when we do, it's effective because we have this other foundation. And so the fact that it isn't is kind of interesting. And even with Memphis having a top 10 offense right now, again, it's 14th in half-court offense, and against top 10 defenses, that's 22nd. And so, like, what does that look like when teams can now nail down this is how they want to rotate, and ultimately, these are the guys that are rotating? Because the other thing that's kind of stood out with the drive stats, in particular with Memphis, is that in terms of help defenders present, they are, I guess, technically top of the league, but they have the lowest number by a wide margin on their front. So the way that they cut and the way that they move, that has opened up driving lanes to a real degree. If teams are like, hey, we know you're shifting, we're going to zone up anyway, we're going to take away some of these rim attempts, and we're going to dare these guys to knock down shots from the perimeter, like, how does Memphis counter in that regard? Especially in light of, again, their 22nd in half-court offense against top 10 defenses, and they are 4-7 in those games against top 10 defenses. Do they have counters? Will their guys make enough shots? It's kind of where my brain goes from there. But, like, again, ultimately, it's been an enjoyable experience for me watching Olympus.
Yeah, cutting from one corner to the other like Danny Green used to. Anyways, I think your point there about the half-court offense was interesting. I'd be intrigued to see what the breakdown looked like in that game against Houston, because it kind of felt like they started to do a couple different things offensively to try and find a rhythm. It's been fun to watch. I think the biggest thing is it's given them flow outside of the first thing. It's taken them out of, we have to wait for Ja Morant to get a screen and then hope something works, which is a positive. And they can kind of just keep attacking, keep flowing, keep moving, keep spacing, and you can kind of get teams in a bind. But I think the half-court offense point, they still got to nail that. And then if a team is very good defensively and has the matchups and can keep the ball in front, what do you do now then? I think this is probably, as you said, one of the bigger ones.
Okay. There we go. And a quick salute to Memphis. Did lose to Houston, though. So Houston, a little bit more of a gap, the 2 seed in the West. So shout out to Houston as well. But that will conclude there. Last one going to come from Nolan, who says, hey, y'all, 2 questions for you amazing people. Number one, I am looking to dive more into hoops, and I'm wondering what websites or streaming options y'all would suggest on using. I found myself replaying the same set play from Iowa State a good dozen times while watching it live. Just stop there. To do the deep dive into hoops, like I would say, one, if you're watching NBA basketball or W basketball, like just the league pass options are going to be your best bet. So you can watch games live. And if you want to watch them back, as you mentioned, enjoying rewinding and stuff like that, being able to slow things down, like having league pass and being able to go back to different games and watch at your own pace, pause, rewind, et cetera, et cetera. It's going to help you pick up more stuff, help you note take, et cetera. So I'll start there on the watching front. As far as what I use for stats, non-public side, like I do have the Second Spectrum subscription right now. So any tracking data, what are these teams doing? And pick and roll versus specific coverage, et cetera. Like that's not why it's not readily available. So more of the public side, PBP stats is what I would use for lineup data and some of the player stats, like getting some of the funkier ones, like who's blocked the most threes and stuff like that. I'll use PBP stats for, but that's mostly lineup data. What does the Thunder look like with Shea and Jalen Williams on the floor versus Shea plus bench or whatever the case may be? Like those splits are easy to see. So that's mostly the lineup data for me. For cleaning the glass, you do need a subscription for that to get the full breadth of it. Like you can't still see some stuff, but that's not a heavy financial burden. So that's certainly more doable than Second Spectrum, to put it that way. But that's where I get a lot of my team stats. You'll see me cite the offensive rating and defensive rating and stuff on cleaning the glass since they exclude garbage time, and I like that part. You can also get lineup data on there, which, again, factors in or excludes garbage time. So if you want those specific numbers, you can. But team stats and like shot profile stuff is where I'll go to cleaning the glass for offense and defense. You also get, you know, related to the team stats. We just talked about Memphis and their overall offensive rating and their half court offensive rating, being able to split things up like that. It's a good site for that. With Basketball Reference, that's where I get a lot of my box score stuff, especially since they have 2-point percentage and 3-point percentage and effective field goal percentage stuff split up. They have their own advanced stats tab, et cetera. So it's easier for me to see that kind of thing. And for game logs, I think Basketball Reference is where you want to go. You can go to the player page or team page. You can do the clickables to get the last 6 games or a random 4-game stretch here, last 12 games, et cetera, et cetera. And in the player splits tab, you can see what they're doing month by month. If you want to see how someone's done in November compared to December, it's an easy way to see that. You can see the starter versus reserve splits and stuff like that. You can see team by team breakdowns, what the Shea average against the Lakers versus what he averages against the Grizzlies versus that kind of thing. And then dunks and threes, I think it's also subscription-based, but not a heavy financial investment. That's where you'll hear me cite EPM sometimes. That's probably my favorite advanced stat out there. They also have like schedule-adjusted offensive rating and defense rating and stuff like that if you want to get deeper into reads for team stats. But those are the ones that I use primarily. So get League Pass to watch. Those are the stat sites if you want to dig in that regard.
Bro, you need less stats.
Fair enough. Steve.
What?
Oh, yeah. Questions for both of us amazing people.
What? You know, all right, never. You just gave 18. What do you want me to do?
What do you use? I gave what I use.
My television and the computer. What you mean?
Fair enough. Well, this second one is more for you than me, so we can flip-flop here. Also, I am interested in coaching at the youth level soon. While I have experience in coaching teenagers in baseball, I have yet to coach basketball. What qualities do you think are most important for a youth coach? I love the X's and O's, but I also love how pure and joyful kids can be when learning to love a sport. Just wanted your thoughts on the ideal youth coach.
Teach them, communicate with them, develop them, teach them lessons that sports will give them. But show up, be there, be an inspiration, let them express themselves, and off to the races. Have fun.
Very succinct. Huh? Be a positive influence to the youth. Also, just a best of luck on that front. And I say that earnestly. But I think anyone that willingly commits to shaping young minds in sports, like, I think it's a kudos to me, especially if you're doing it the right way. So, like, as you go into that journey, like, I hope it is a joyous experience for everyone involved. So salute to you for making that commitment, and wish you the best. Want to get some, hey, we want a report back. Like, Pa's going to keep going. The mailbag's going to keep going. And chime in a few months from now, like, hey, this is how first basketball season's going, et cetera. We want to hear back.
What if they didn't do it?
Well, then I guess there would be nothing to report back with. Gosh darn it. Well, on that note, Steve, do you have any free throws?
I did.
You don't have any more? did the stats thing just break you?
Man, but more surprising, Cat's year or Cade Cunningham's year?
More surprise. I guess Cade by default, like, both of them had the talent to do this. I guess Cade having the assist bump to this degree, him being this good of a pull-up shooter, and the Pistons just flirting around 500, I guess, to all of it. I guess I'll give the lean to Cade in that front.
More surprising year, Norm Powell or Cam Johnson?
Probably Cam. I didn't expect the off-the-dribble juice to look like this for this kind of sample. But he's been better with the ball in his hand since he's joined Brooklyn, but this feels like another, like, a real leap for him. So that part's been cool.
Who do you believe in more, Kyle Kuzma or Terry Rozier?
No.
Lauri Markkanen or Paul George?
Probably Lauri.
That's all the free throws I got. What you got, big dog?
Fair enough, fair enough. Who do you trust more in a playoff setting, the Grizzlies or the Rockets?
Probably the Grizzlies right now. Even though the Rockets just beat them, I think they have enough on both ends that they've showcased. If Houston does the offense thing, which almost got them in trouble in that game, it's interesting.
Okay. Who you trust more in the playoff setting, the Los Angeles Lakers or the Los Angeles Clippers?
Yes.
Ah, I see. I see. Who's the third best team in the East?
The third best team in the East?
Yeah.
I mean, it depends on the day. Probably the Knicks.
Probably next. Okay. What do the Bucks have to do to crack that for you?
Keep winning games. Keep playing defense. They're up there.
Okay. Okay. Talked about this more in the watch party than on the pod, but any concern about the Chris Middleton minutes restriction coming off the bench? He's still dealing with some lower body stuff. You want to make sure he's good?
No, just make sure he's fine.
Okay. Fair enough. Fair enough. More likely to win the title this season, the Knicks or the Mavericks?
Probably Dallas.
Probably Dallas. Okay. Related to Dallas, PJ Washington is their blank most important player.
Third or fourth, depending on the day.
Okay. Okay. Better defender, Bam Adebayo or Evan Mobley?
Bam.
Okay. I do appreciate how much you appreciate Bam and what he does. he does not have an easy job and has not had an easy job for pretty much the entirety of his career as a starter.
Man, don't get me wrong. Evan Mobley is a force defensively, but Bam has to do a lot.
That he does. Whose offense do you trust more, Orlando's or Minnesota's?
Orlando's. And I can say that because Paolo Banchero is coming back today.
Yeah. I'm excited. Paolo, an electric five games, kept with the 50 ball, I believe. And then he's just out. It's like, well, darn. And so adding that kind of fulcrum to the offense should obviously help Orlando, who has continued to defend at a super high level during the time that he's been out. And now him and Franz have been out. The offense naturally has fallen off of a cliff with those two out of the lineup. But as Steve says all the time, we may not be able to score, but you can't either. And that puts them in a lot of games. So shout out to the Orlando Magic. Better rapper, Damian Lillard or LiAngelo Ball?
Dame Dolla.
Okay. Okay. No love for the woe. I see. That's
well, that's not how you can paint it. You asked me who the better rapper is.
No, I'm just saying, you know. I think, doesn't Angela have more music dropping, like, literally today?
Do you think I know the answer to that question? We're never recording on a Friday morning ever again. Hit the horns.
That's crazy. Well, thank you for listening to this episode of the Dunker Spot, and also Jello, I suppose. If you haven't already, please subscribe to us. We're on Apple, Spotify, RIP Google, Stitcher, Podbean, wherever you get your podcasts. You can find us every Tuesday. That's the day after Monday, the day before Wednesday. We are on the Young Man of the Three YouTube channel, formerly the JJ Reddit YouTube channel. Some really good stuff on the channel. Naturally, come listen to us, but also a lot of Celtic content on the channel this week. I think Peyton Pritchard and Derek White on this week. So check that out if you haven't already. But again, we're there every Tuesday. So if you want to see plays spliced in as we're talking about them, Steve reaction to some of my ridiculous opinions, you can see that live and in action on Tuesday. You can follow me on Blue Sky at Nikias NBA. You can follow Steve at SteveJones20. Join the online Dunker Spot watch parties. The link is in the description. If you want to watch hoops with us, you have a League Pass subscription, create your profile, link that League Pass subscription. It is free to create your profile, by the way. And you can watch hoops with us. Live reactions, live breakdowns. We have end of game fun. We'll break down what happened, why it worked, why it didn't, etc. Beyond that, a lot of silliness. We'll have random videos playing that we get to laugh at, wrestling commentary, some video game fun. Marvel Rivals, we've had Fall Guys up in the room, we played 2K, we played College Football 25, the Dunker Dynasty still going, I think year six, I think is what we're in right now, but a lot of fun, so if you want to have some fun with us, watch some hoops, and in general, just have a good time, come rock with us, links in the description, sign up, come say hi, and with that, we will catch y'all next week.
Bye.